The views expressed on the Making It Matter podcast are that of Gunnar Esiason, Julia Ray, and guests, and not necessarily those of the Boomer Esiason Foundation. Nothing in the Making It Matter podcast should be considered medical advice. Such advice can only be given by a physician who is experienced with cystic fibrosis. The Boomer Esiason Foundation, Gunnar Esiason, Julia Ray, and guests cannot be held responsible for any damage which may result from using the information on this podcast without the permission of your medical doc. You're listening to the Making It Matter podcast with Gunnar Esiason and Julia Ray, presented by the Boomer Esiason Foundation and GunnarEsiason.com.
Hey, there's Gunnar Esiason, and thanks for joining Julie and I for episode 36 of the Making It Matter podcast series, Cystic Fibrosis and Motherhood.
Hi, everyone. Making It Matter is a weekly podcast presented by the Boomer Esiason Foundation and GunnarEsiason.com, highlighting the challenges that people with CF face and the people who face them.
Since Julia, our guest, and I all have cystic fibrosis, we're remaining compliant with the National Cystic Fibrosis Guidelines regarding patient interaction and cross-infection by recording via Skype. This podcast was made possible by Novartis, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, and the Digital Credit Union. So big thanks to them for always supporting Boomer Esiason Foundation educational initiatives. So today we're actually excited to have another guest on the program, Marge Carfora. She's 34 years old with cystic fibrosis. She was diagnosed at 3 months. She had a double lung transplant done quite a while ago in 2004, and most recently a cervical cancer and breast cancer survivor as well. So quite the full plate for her. And she's also a recent mom of now two twins. So congratulations to her. Marge, thanks for joining the program. And why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Great. Thanks, guys. I'm so excited to be here and talk about something that's really important. And now that CF patients are getting older, motherhood and parenthood is really coming into the forefront of our lives, and it's a big decision we have to make. I always wanted to be a mom, so I was happy that I was able to do that. Obviously, growing up, it kind of was a question mark if I'd get there. I had the typical CF upbringing, just kind of slowed down as I got older. In about fourth grade, I needed my first IV antibiotics, in and out of the hospital after that, feeding tube when I was 14, trouble walking up the stairs, trouble keeping up with my peers, but none of that stopped me. I decided I really wanted to go to college, and I did that. And probably in 2003 is when I really became very ill and took a turn for the worse, and I got listed for a double lung transplant. And ever since then, life has been remarkably different. I ran a half marathon after my transplant, go to the gym regularly when I can now that I have twins. That's a little bit more difficult. But just try to keep an active lifestyle and be up and out, and started my career in Manhattan right out of college. So just a really, really full life, despite all of the medical diagnoses that I do have.
Oh, certainly sounds like it. Awesome for you for going through all this. So let's go one layer at a time here. Let's go first start pre-transplant days. You said you had a G-tube. I have a G-tube as well. Yep. So I love talking about that. What was it like growing up with cystic fibrosis and also having a feeding tube?
It was really difficult. And I think one of the most difficult things was I got it when I was 14. It was the second day of my freshman year of high school. So you're really starting this new life, these new people you're going to meet. And then all of a sudden I'm out and I have to get this major surgery. And I got it on a Friday and forced myself to go back to school on Monday because I just didn't want to miss anything. And I just wanted to be a part of everything. And you realize just how hard and difficult having the feeding tube is. It's all of those feedings overnight. I would feel sick overnight, feel sick in the morning, just like from being full. But once you got used to it, I reaped the benefits of having a feeding tube. I mean, I gained so much weight. I got so healthy. That's how I ended up being able to get healthy enough to go to college. If I would have gotten sick probably when I was 14 or 15, I did not have enough weight to fight anything off. So it was, while it was difficult, you realize the benefits outweigh anything bad about it.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way about the feeding tube. I think it's one of those things where there's certainly a stigma attached to it because of the appearance of it, and it's also you're adding really 6 hours of work because you're going to be doing pumps overnight and stuff like that. But after you get used to it, as far as I'm concerned, it was really is the easiest thing that I had to do as a CF patient. It's like there's very little maintenance around the feeding tube. I feel the same exact way as you did. You got to get used to the feeling of being full all the time and sort of constantly pumping yourself full of calories. But that's I definitely understand how that someone's health within the CF world can correlate to their weight.
Oh yeah, absolutely. For me, it was a huge thing. And my issue my whole life was weight and keeping that on. When I went in for transplant, I was only 78 pounds. Mm-hmm. So I was really, really tiny. When I came out of transplant, I was 72. At my height, when I was really healthy with CF and at the end of high school, I was up to like 99 pounds. Mm-hmm. So that goes to show you just when your body is working and the feeding tube is working, how great it can be for you. So. Yeah.
And we talk a lot about college. Like, how did you balance all of that with college? And then you said you went to Manhattan after college. So can you speak a little bit about that and adjusting to the real world as we've
yeah.
it?
Yeah,
guys, Julie and I both come to know.
I think college, the first day was really scary for me. And I remember being in my dorm room and I had all of this medical equipment. And all I could think at that time was, I got to hide all of this because I just don't want anybody to know. And I had been really open about it in high school, but that took me a while. And I kind of reverted a little bit in college and started to keep it close to the vest again. And then as soon as like I moved in, I kind of hid my feeding tube pole. I hid all of my, like my vest and, you know, any nebulizers I didn't want anybody to see. And then as I got comfortable, like I just opened up again and started telling people. And it just wasn't a big deal. And everybody, you know, got on board and was very supportive. And you know, I think the best thing for me about college was just the walking around campus, going to class. Like there was a little bit more time than there was in high school because you don't have classes all day. But just the exercise of just walking around campus, I think really helped to keep me in shape. With that being said, I also did go through my rebellious phase in college. So where I wanted to go out and drink too much and not do my therapy, and I probably skipped way too many PTs and nebulizers. And I think, honestly, that's probably what got me in a little bit of trouble sooner than I would have maybe needed a transplant. Mm-hmm. So it was the end of my sophomore year going into my junior year that I was in the hospital for 3 weeks. They told family to come see me if they wanted to see me. There was a question whether I was going to get out of it or not. But I made it out of there, was on oxygen full time from that point, and knew I needed a lung transplant when I left there.
So after your sophomore year of college, it is?
After my sophomore year of college, yeah.
Oh, wow. So after college, then how long between graduating college and being listed was it?
So it was actually, I got listed my junior year of college.
Okay.
On my winter break, I finished my exams. On my winter break, I went for my 3 days of testing at UPenn. Uh-huh. And back then, so this was 2003 going into 2004, it was how long you were on the list, not how sick you were.
Uh-huh.
So I got on the list and they said, you have 2 years on the list to wait at least. And I was like, that's fine. I'll graduate college. I'll get a transplant and then I'll start my career. It's totally good. I had it all worked out. And of course, you know, life happens when you make those type of plans. And I went back my second semester of my junior year and I went downhill really fast. I couldn't really walk up the stairs anymore. My friends had to help me with my laundry. Like I was driving everywhere on campus now. I couldn't really walk around anymore. I was on oxygen any chance I could get. I would take it off to go to class because I was stubborn and then put it back on the minute I got in the car. So I kind of had a realization halfway through that second semester that I didn't have 2 years to live.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really difficult phone call to make to my parents and just say, I don't think I have 2 years, guys. We have to find another option. And I ended up finding Ochsner Medical Center down in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So I finished my junior year of college, took a medical leave of absence from school, moved to New Orleans in June, got listed, got the call in November, and stayed until March, and then was back in my senior year. So I only missed 1 year of school.
So now how did your friends handle that? You know, what was it like to leave your friends behind and go down to New Orleans? Obviously, a brand new city, you know nothing down there, and sort of have to adjust that lifestyle. Because, you know, people with CF, they do have to move for transplants from time to time. So I definitely think this is a valuable little story here.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very emotional, I would say, and difficult to leave your family and friends. However, it was over the summer that I ended up moving. So we had a revolving door of people coming to visit. So it was, we were dropping somebody off at the airport and we were picking somebody up that same time. So a lot of support, a lot of people coming to visit. And when I did feel well, I was able to get out and kind of see the city. We got a wheelchair so I could kind of do some sightseeing and see what was out there. But we 100% fell in love with the city of New Orleans. The people down there, so nice. The doctors, absolutely amazing. You just kind of, we felt right at home. And I actually did my 10-year celebration in New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
We went back down there. We had a second line band march us through the streets of Bourbon Street. It was just down in the French Quarter. It was amazing to go back to the place that it happened and so many of my family and friends to come with me and just celebrate life.
So now you're on the transplant waiting list and you're going through the process of getting a transplant. You know, what kind of fears and nerves did you have, and what role did your direct family play in sort of helping you cope with that?
So my sister had just graduated college when this all happened, and she was interviewing for a job, and she just was so distracted. And my parents were like, listen, why don't you move down to New Orleans with your sister? So me, my mom, and my sister moved to New Orleans just for support. So my mom and my sister were basically everything. They helped me get dressed, be emotional support, make me laugh. My dad came down every chance he got because he was still working at that time. So he had to have, you know, run two households, one in New Orleans, one in New Jersey. And they, you know, my family and friends were just integral to me getting through that time. So when you kind of feel like life is moving on without you and my senior year was going on, it's easy to kind of go into this kind of sad state about it that you might be missing something. But I had my sister right there for me, who was willing to put her life on hold for me, and my mother, who just, you know, it was my backbone, and we got through it. So, you know, the fear is, am I going to make it through the surgery? Am I going to make it to transplant? Am I going to have a major bleeding episode before then that I'm not going to get out of the hospital for? Am I going to be strong enough to go through the surgery? All of those fears go through your head when you're waiting. And then once it happened, and I had talked to so many people and got so much advice on how to handle the transplant, post-transplant life. And I remember at one point I was like, wow, I have no more questions to ask. And I kind of just went into this like peaceful period of like, I'm just waiting now. And I'm waiting for either for this life to go one way or the other. And I knew which way I wanted it to go, which is the way that it went. And I just became very peaceful in waiting. And when I got the call, I was ready. Either way, I was ready. So, but I'm happy, obviously, it turned out this way.
And so, can you talk about what happened post-transplant immediately, like what life was like, and then kind of just go from there?
Life post-transplant was just immediately different in the way that you can just take a breath like you never have before. And it was something that I realized like right away. I was like, wow, like, oh, I feel so great. And I remember my mom calling the doctors and being like, she has a fever, her cheeks are pink. And the doctors were like, no, that's how she's supposed to look. Like, she's getting oxygen. She doesn't look like gray anymore. So this is like normal. This is all good stuff. So immediately different, but it was an adjustment because now it's not just therapy, it is medication upon medication that you have to keep straight. It's a new routine that you have to get used to. It's, you know, 3 days a week of rehab, doctor's appointments. And that's initially. So initially the rehab and the doctor's appointments are kind of a full-time job to recover. Once I got out of that and I went home and I went back to New Jersey, life kind of became a little bit more normal. I got a job. I started working. I passed the summer. I was really careful not to be around people who were sick because obviously my immune system was so low. And then by September, I was really ready to go back to school and get my life going again. Mm-hmm. But again, just with the added caution, and I know with CF, you have to be so cautious, but even with transplant, just being aware of who is around you that's coughing or has a cold or is sick, and hand washing and Purelling and things like that. So I got through my first year of college, or my last year of college, applied for some jobs in Manhattan, got one, and knew that that is where I was headed. And my sister and I moved into the city together. I lived in the city for 5 years, which was just so much fun. And that's where I met my boyfriends that turned into my fiance and husband, and how all this kid stuff happened.
But now it's my understanding that you also had obviously some complications after the transplant seemed to be so successful.
Yeah. So 5 years into my transplant, I was at the height of my health. I was in the best shape of my life. I was training for a half marathon. I ran the half marathon like nothing could stop me, and I started to have trouble swallowing. Mm-hmm. And I just, it felt like something was stuck in my throat. And I called my doctor and I just said, hey, listen, and I was at the Yankee game on a Sunday having a great time. And I was like, I just don't feel right. I'm going to just, you know, give my doctor a call. And he was like, yeah, these symptoms are a little weird. You should go get checked out. within a week, I had a diagnosis of post-transplant lymphoproliferative disorder, PTLD, which is basically a lymphoma that happens if you're too immunosuppressed. So I was too immunocompromised. I had large B-cell lymphoma. It had basically presented itself with a malignant B-cell tumor wrapped around my esophagus. So very aggressive, very malignant. I mean, when the doctor called me, he was like, you need to get this treated right away because this will kill you. So, and I had just started a new job that week too. So that was,
so there's a lot going on. So now, so how did you take care of that? What was, you know, what was the next step?
I had to do 4 rounds of a medication called Rituxan. So it wasn't quite chemotherapy. It was the step before chemo. So I didn't lose my hair or anything like that, but, it definitely wreaked havoc on my body. It took me probably a full year to recover from that. But after 4 rounds of Rituxan, the esophageal cancer was gone, so I could kind of put that to rest, and then my body just had to get back to normal after that medication.
So I understand that. I understand that's sort of like a common post-transplant side effect.
It is. Yep, it is. It's not something that's uncommon, and especially I think in the first 5 years is usually when you see it pop up. And I got lucky because I felt a physical symptom from it, so I felt pain. And I was, you know, again, with everything like we have to do, we have to be vigilant. You can't sit on anything. You always have to call your doctor, and I called my doctor right away about that one.
So and then from there, it sounds like things sort of were okay, and then they fell apart again.
They fell apart again. And it's funny, like I had met my boyfriend, who is now my husband, probably 6 months before I got diagnosed with PTLD. So we were on like a, we were kind of in that phase where we didn't know which way our relationship was going to go. And then this PTLD happened, and I told him, I was like, listen, if this is too much for you, like, this is how my life is going to be. You can, you know, feel free to leave. Like, I care enough about you to do that. And he was like, where am I going? I love you. And I'm like, okay, you can stay. We kind of knew from that point on that this was something that was serious, that we were going to be together for forever. So it kind of pushed us into, you know, the direction our relationship was going, which is great. So, and then I had a couple of years where it was pretty quiet other than some, you know, cold viruses that I catch easily, things like that. But probably I'm trying to think of the year now, it's 2017. So I think in 2014 going into 2015 is when I found out I had cervical cancer. So it was a very small area. It's considered cervical cancer in situ, which basically is stage 0. So it was very easily fixed by surgery. So I didn't have to do anything else. And thank God, since then, I haven't had any issues there. So we're good with that. So,
and is that common post-transplant as well?
It is. It is something that becomes for women an issue that could pop up post-transplant. Yes.
Now for listeners who may not know, why is that an issue? Is it because of the immunosuppressants that you're taking and things
like that? The immunosuppressive drugs. So your immune system is lower. And if you have cervical changes, they can just turn into the cancer.
Yeah. So for people who are listening who may not be familiar with transplant science, you have to take immunosuppressors so that your body accepts the newly transplanted organs and it doesn't sort of see it as a foreign object entering the body. Because obviously you want your body to understand that the organs are here to help and not harm.
Exactly.
So you brushed off cervical cancer, whatever, not a big deal. we're back on the tracks, back on the horses, they like to say. On to the next thing.
Yeah, again, everything was relatively quiet. And me and my husband got married in 2009, and we knew we wanted to start a family, you know, fairly quickly. So we needed to kind of, or no, not 2009, sorry. We got married on November 9th of 2013. Sorry, I mixed up my dates. But
we won't tell him you screwed that up.
don't tell him that. He won't watch. So we kind of knew we needed to start thinking about a family right away because it was going to be a long process because we were going to do a surrogate. So we had our first appointment with a fertility center in February of 2014 just to kind of start that process of, you know, what needs to be done, how do we go through this, egg retrieval and things like that.
This is a few months after the cervical cancer, obviously.
It was after the cervical cancer. Yes. It might've been right around the same time as the cervical cancer. So we move forward and of course we go through genetic testing. And of course I picked a man to marry who has the CF gene as well. So we found that out and we decided we really did have to take a break from the whole kid discussion. 'Cause we were like, wow, this is really heavy. I have CF, they're only getting a CF gene from me. Now you carry a gene too that, you know, gives each of our babies a 50% chance of having CF. And, you know, that was something that we really needed to consider about moving forward. And I talked to my fertility center and they put us in touch with a genetic, basically company out in Chicago that makes a special probe to highlight Jimmy's genetics so that we could pick the embryos that did not have cystic fibrosis. Uh-huh. So, and we, that was, you know, obviously a personal choice for us that we just wanted to kind of give our, you know, children the best chance that we could. And one person with CF in the family is a lot. So we kind of felt that let's, you know, go for the healthy embryos if we can. So we decided to charge forward.
That's the miracle of science right there.
It really is. It, back in the day, that wasn't possible, you know? And so the fact that we can identify this gene and, you know that it's there and pick the ones that are the carriers, that was really important to us. And I know that might be controversial to some people, for sure. But that was just what was right for our family.
And you have to do what you have to do ultimately. I mean, that's just the way it works. Mm-hmm.
And what were there any fears or anxieties, I mean, I'm sure, about surrogacy and like moving forward with that? And can you talk about that experience as a whole, really? Because now you're...
Oh, yeah. So we were in the midst of everything. We made our embryos first. We had 5 frozen in a storage facility. I celebrated my 10-year transplant anniversary. And then it was, okay, now we need to hire an agency to find us a surrogate. And the fear with that is like, am I ever going to trust a complete stranger that I know nothing about to carry my child?
Yeah.
Like, is that even remotely possible? And, you know, the counselors and everybody you talk to in the fertility center always say, like, yes, you are going to find somebody that you completely trust. And they were so right. We really found somebody who was just an amazing person, willing to help us, wanted to help a woman who just couldn't have a baby because she has her own and she couldn't imagine not being able to have a child. So she really wanted to help. And, you know, as soon as I met her in person, every single fear I had, like, went away. But of course, it's, you know, financial. There's no guarantee that you're going to implant embryos and they're going to take. So it's the fear of finances. We might put all this money in and not, at the end of the day, get a baby. So that was very, very scary too.
And you have twins. So
we have twins. So yeah, the last year of my life has definitely been insane. So last year, I kept getting sick. Every cold that went around, I just ended up getting. And for the first time in 10 years, I needed IV antibiotics. And I was like, wow, this is like a throwback. I haven't done this in so long. But, you know, let's just get this, like, knock it out of me. Like, I need to be better because it was really just starting to get in the way of everything. So during that time, I had lost about 10 pounds. And that's at the time that I felt the lump in my breast. So I kind of was like, maybe it might not be anything. So like, let's just continue doing what we're doing and move forward. So we had this wonderful surrogate. We implanted our embryos on May 1st. And then I found out we were pregnant on Mother's Day last year on May 8th. And then I found out I had breast cancer on May 16th. So it was a whirlwind, to say the least.
Sounds like it.
Oh yeah. Overnight I added like another 4 doctors to my list of doctors I have to go see. And I was like, okay, we're just a little busy. We'll get through it. And we bought a house at the same time too. So it was like every major life event that we could go through, we decided to crush into 1 year. So yeah, it was, you know, simultaneously, and hopefully not everybody has to go through that when you're having babies and surrogacy, you're just focusing on that, but definitely doing everything simultaneously was a little difficult, but we got through it.
And then how did you handle the breast cancer? I mean, like everything else.
like everything else, you just kind of make quick decisions, but quick informed, you know, don't sit on anything, acted really, really fast, went to some of the best doctors in Manhattan. Did a bilateral mastectomy with immediate reconstruction and called it a day. I did not want the fear of this for the rest of my life and the biopsies and the anxiety that comes with waiting for the results. It was just, I just couldn't handle it.
So then at the end of it, so you've now tested cancer-free.
Yes.
Obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's fantastic.
I got lucky. I caught it early. Again, like, I know this is about CF, but for women to do their self-checks, because I caught it on my self-check, caught it really, really early, and it didn't hit the lymph node, so I didn't need chemo or radiation, which was huge for me, because that would have definitely ravaged it, you know, anybody's body, but especially after transplant. So
yeah, absolutely. So yep. All right, so now you're a mom with CF and transplant and 3-time cancer survivor. So just to add to the list.
and a full-time job.
And you have a job, yeah. So how do you balance all of that?
A lot of organization and a lot of help. So mm-hmm. I would say that people still make fun of me because I have like a paper calendar, but it's literally the only way I can run my life. Like I know every appointment that I have to be at, when I have to be there, what I have to do for my kids, you know, everything in my house is super in place, in order. There's a process in place for everything. Cause especially you don't just have one baby, you have two babies. So there's a bottle washing process. There's the laundry process. It is like, keep everything moving in order. And the help, like my husband is amazing. He takes on so much, and he knows when the kids are sick, he has to take on more because I can't do that. My parents, his parents, my sister who lives next door to us, just it is a village. And I never really understood that whole it takes a village thing until I had twins. It takes a village. Oh, yeah. And I think I know, like with CF people, we really like to do things ourselves. And I think that's because when we do lose control and need help, it's so hard for us and we like to get that control back, or that's how I am anyway. Mm-hmm. So for me to actually admit like, oh man, I need help. Like that was really, really hard. But my parents and his parents were so willing to step right into that and say, whatever you need. Like, we know you need to go to the doctor. We're there to watch the kids that day. You know, we know you need to, don't forget to take your, you know, blood sugar and your medication and all that. Like, I need to do all that so that I can be here for my kids. Cause if I don't, then I won't be. So mm-hmm. that's just as important in the day as it is taking care of them.
So I mean, obviously you've been through so much, and it seems like you had the ultimate reward in having two amazing twin babies. Was there ever a moment when you felt like there was just too much and it was just so completely overwhelming? And I know a lot of people with CF, they fight frustration and anxiety and mm-hmm. all these things and stress, but was there ever a moment when, you know, you're just like, wow, I'm going through all this again?
Oh, I mean, definitely. I would be lying if I said it's, you know, sunshine and flowers all the time, right? And I think that there are moments, especially when you need to really take care of yourself and you realize I'm up every 3 hours to feed newborns, and it's just, it's exhausting and you're tired and you're like, oh my God, this is just, it's a lot. And I can't sleep in tomorrow because I have to get up to go to Manhattan to go to a doctor tomorrow. So mm-hmm. There's definitely a lot, and there's a lot to balance. But once you do find that time to kind of recharge and take care of yourself, and you can put it all back into perspective and say, okay, I can handle all of this. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and there were definitely times last year when I was seeing, you know, 5 million doctors and working and, you know, managing just the surrogacy process from afar, because my surrogate was in Kansas, that it was super overwhelming and like, wow, this is a lot to handle. Like I think I said a couple of times, my plate is full. Like mm-hmm. my plate is definitely full. But once I saw those two babies in the OR after the C-section, I was just like, nothing else matters. This was worth every fear, tear, stress, anxiety, all of it. It's just so worth it.
It absolutely sounds that way. You know, and I think, I think if you could say something to women, older women with CF that are maybe planning on becoming mothers themselves and may have some stress about, you know, how to prioritize the right thing and how to also maintain a job and, mm-hmm. you know, how are you able to not only take care of yourself, but also, you know, work as well and maintain a finance, you know, a stream of income for yourself and your family?
So I think, and I go back to surrounding yourself with people that love you and are willing to step in and take some of the items off of your plate. I think that's the only way that I survive. Mm-hmm. I think that's the only way that I can do everything. If I didn't have the amount of help that I have, I think it would be really, really difficult and I'd get run into the ground mm-hmm. very fast. So to the extent that you can, having as much help as you can is going to just make your life a little bit easier at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's my biggest advice.
Well, that's certainly something that I think a lot of our listeners can certainly hang their head on. It for me, for sure. You know, I think my biggest problem is always asking for help. I love to micromanage things. It's a budding skill for me, as Julia has found after knowing me for a year with this podcast.
Letting go. It's letting go of some of it and realizing, okay, if it's not done exactly the way I want it to be done, and somebody else can pick this up and take it off of my plate, then my kids will be happier later because they'll have more of my attention. And, you know, I had a chance to take my meds or do what I had to do, and I can be there for them. So that's, you know, it's just letting go, which is really hard.
Yeah.
I can only imagine.
But it gives you back some of your sanity. So
it does.
It's so important.
Yes, it is very important. How about you guys? Are you guys thinking about kids in the future? Is this something that resonates with you folks? Or I just turned the script on both of you.
As at heart, I'm still a 5-year-old at heart. So
yeah. I'm still trying to figure out how to take care of myself.
I think it's obviously the goal one day is to obviously create a family and move to that point. But I personally am in no rush.
Yeah, fair enough.
But hearing your story is definitely inspiration and gives us a picture, a beautifully painted picture of like what it can look like. So thank you so much for sharing it.
Yeah,
absolutely. Anytime.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. And I hope so many listeners get a real good feel for what it's like to go through something and ultimately have the greatest reward possible at the end of the trail, so to speak.
Absolutely.
But thanks everyone for listening to the 36th episode. That's all the time we have for today. Remember, you can follow along with our weekly podcast via my YouTube channel on GunnarAsiason.com or JuliaRay.com. You can also follow us on iTunes, and if you do, like, share, and review. Those are the big three. And then you can also follow Instagram, which is Julia
at makingitmatter_CF.
Yes. And if you want to see us podcast about something specific, or if you want to get in touch with us like Marge did and put your story out there, we'd love that too. You can email us. My email is gunnersblog@assiason.org. And Julia's fantastically original email address.
It's juliaray@juliaray.com.
Yes. And you can send either of us a message on our Facebook like pages, our fan pages, whatever you want to call them. Marge, thanks so much for joining us today.
Anytime.
It's really been a fantastic podcast. This is Gunnar Assiason and Julia Ray signing off.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.